My starting point will be six proper names and six quotes, and I'll stick to them in a way. It's a constellation that I'm probably more theoretical, as one would expect in our traditional culture, from a male. I have to take responsibility for this, I guess. So, six proper names accompanied each by a quote, which can be either a sentence or a work of art, eventually, or even more, a body of work. Three of those proper names are artists, three of our so-called theoreticians, two are women and four are men. So, one, Manet painted a woman, this particular woman, Victorine Meurent, cette fille de nos jours que vous rencontrez sur votre trottoir, said Zola, a puny model stretched out on a sheet with the color of her flesh dirty, Gautier Peyre, an odalisque with a yellow stomach, a base model picked up I don't know where, quote by Jules Clarty, that's the critics of the time. Yet, he called her Olympia, a goddess among gods. Yet, he modeled her after Titian's Venus of Urbino, the epitome of classical idealized beauty. Yet, he wanted his painting to rest in the Louvre forever, and there it is. Would Olympia's yellow stomach, bony figure, callous knees, and daring gaze have raised such an uproar if, beyond all her particularities, she were not to stand for a new, provocative, and paradoxical model of woman, that is, of beauty, or of painting, or of art? Moreover, would she actually hang in the Louvre if she did not embody such a claim to universality? And finally, does that have anything to do with the fact that it is a man who painted that woman? Can we simultaneously praise Manet for having demolished or deconstructed the classical authoritarian canon of female beauty and reproach him for not having abandoned that male fantasy altogether? Two, Godard had first called the film he made hastily and purposively for the 1966 Venice Biennale, La Femme Mariée. The French censorship board found it pornographic, yet apparently felt satisfied that the film should be left unchanged if Godard would only redub it Une Femme Mariée. Here the same claim to universality had to be relinquished, so that on the one hand, the film ceased to be regarded as pornographic, and on the other hand, would be allowed to enter that mini pantheon of movie making which is the Venice Biennale. The first aspect confirms the case made for Manet, the second contradicts it. Is this the result of 100 years of modernism? Art authorities shying away from what they once regarded as their ideological responsibility as value setters? And is the fact that the artist is left alone with the claim to universality embedded in the movie's title another manifestation of the same male fantasy, by now overtly misogynous? Three, the same Jean-Luc Godard, however, is also known to have said, I quote, "We need to show that there is no model, there's only modeling." End of quote. No model, no paradigm for masculin-féminin, another title of a movie by Godard, no idealized womanhood, no beauty, neither Venus nor Olympia. There's only modeling, role-playing, wandering without identity amidst an endless series of images, like a chameleon. An adequate description of Cindy Sherman's work, as a matter of fact. And this is art done by a woman this time. The chameleon, however, takes on the color of its background. And indeed, models, if only provisional and ridiculed by their proliferation, provide the background for Cindy Sherman's metamorphosis. Taken from movies or other sources of popular culture, they are unmistakably male, and if not denounced, at least revealed as such. Here is womanhood itself, the male fantasy of womanhood, la femme, exposed through parody in each of these images by a woman, this particular woman artist, modeling for herself, just as Victorine Meurent was modeling for Manet. But is she actually modeling for herself? Since she cannot and doesn't want to claim any of her impersonations as her own identity. How long can such a practice be sustained till she will have made her point? Or hasn't she made her point yet? Can it be avoided that the endless metonymic concatenation of images be at some point turned into a model, a universal symbol of modeling itself? Does the fact that Cindy Sherman is a woman make that avoidance possible? Does it make it desirable? Four, it seems so, for many feminist intellectuals at least, who have been prompt to adopt Lacanian psychoanalysis as a theoretical ground enabling them to refute some essentialist and regressive universalizations of womanhood, such as the womb, the goddess, Mother Nature, and the like, or any other idealized fetishization of the female genitals, a la Judy Chicago, for example. Is it so that Lacan's famous assertion, la femme n'existe pas, woman doesn't exist, has been, curiously enough, enthusiastically taken over by many feminists as a sort of tabula rasa, doing away with all male fantasies of womanhood, because it enabled them, at last, to think of les femmes in their differences, women. It would be oversimplifying to say so. Nevertheless, the demise of universality was very much at stake when Lacan said again, il n'y a pas la femme, article défini pour désigner l'universel. In any case, feminist criticism runs together with so-called postmodernist criticism on this issue. Both entail a strong undermining of all claims to universality. Yet, it seems now that Lacanian feminism finds itself entrapped in its own orthodoxy, and that Lacan's La Femme n'existe pas has backfired. Just as, in Lacan's view, the female libido defines itself only in reference to the phallic function from which springs the discourse of the hysteric, so are women denied the universality of this impossible womanhood, which for men nevertheless subsists as the symbolic locus of otherness, which is woman's jouissance. There's no translation for that. The struggle to which Lacanian or post or ex-Lacanian feminists such as Lucy Rigaret or Michel Monrelet have been led shows what is at stake. The very possibility for a woman's discourse or art practice to accede to the symbolic without sustaining itself with a phallic reference. What it could mean is that universality has been once again denied to women. Five, the irony of this situation is that, under the banner of postmodernism, the demise of universality has been recently, and yet not so recently, it's after all a very modernist affair, acclaimed as a progressive breakthrough. Sometimes, the demise of universality is simply equated with pluralism, or worse, relativism, which are rather weak versions of anti-universalism. Sometimes it is fostered in the name of polysemy, deconstruction, difference, or singularity. Always It passes for anti-authoritarianism, political concern for minorities, the voice of the oppressed, or the other. Often, it is associated, as far as art criticism and aesthetics are concerned, with a critique of the idealism that modernism has inherited from the Enlightenment, and of Kantian aesthetics in particular. All this rightly so. And yet, it involves a major misunderstanding. One, it should be shown, that is rooted, among other things, in a very pernicious and ironically typically modernist misreading of Kant. When Kant said, "In the judgment of taste, nothing is postulated but a universal voice," the emphasis should be put on postulated, and the interpretation should show that for Kant, and even more so for us, a set of postulates is anything but a belief system. More attention should also be paid to Kant's comment on this sentence. I quote, "The judgment of taste itself does not postulate the agreement of everyone. It only imputes this agreement to everyone as a case of the rule in respect of which it expects not confirmations by concepts, but assent from others. The universal voice is, therefore, only an idea." End of quote. Let the emphasis here again be put on the word only, and let the Kantian notion of a regulative idea, of reason, which is as far from Platonism as one can imagine, be given its full credit, and you will realize that the postmodernist, and eventually, in some case, feminist, attacks on universalism, which are in fact down and all modernist, are only one side of a Kantian antinomy. Yes, indeed, universality, or the fantasy of universality, that is, realized, acted out universality, ought to be criticized, abandoned, denounced, and deconstructed. In it are the seeds of totalitarianism. But on the other hand, the claim to universality, as claim that knows itself to be nothing more than a claim, cannot be relinquished. To forsake that claim would amount to admitting that aesthetic values, and for that matter, moral and political values as well, of which aesthetic values were for Kant symbolic, are exchangeable and indifferent. Anything goes would be the motto of such a pluralism or such a liberalism, as it were, which would have forgotten or repressed the lesson of the Enlightenment. For the claim to universality as a historical task, and that is what it was for Kant, once spelled out in Kant's time, liberté, égalité, fraternité. When in the second moment of the Analytic of the Beautiful, third critique, Kant said that the aesthetic judgment was by the same token singular and universal, he kept both sides of the antinomy in mind. He still urges us to do so. Only if we do, do we begin to understand why Manet's Olympia, this woman, all too singular to be raised to the level of a universal model, actually hangs in the loop. Why Godard, who insisted on the need to show that there is no model, only modeling, was provocatively right in wanting to call his movie La Femme Mariée. Why Cindy Sherman's endless modeling leaves us unsatisfied, as if her work still relied on the male gaze to provide it with the access to the symbolic where women could start speaking for themselves. And why post-Lacanian feminists ultimately felt bereft of the political impetus they got from Lacan in the first place. Universality is too dangerous a thing to be left to those who claim it only for themselves. Six, there is and can be no conclusion to this train of thoughts. One thing is certain. Falling back on Kant is by no way the last word of it. For the examples above, starting with Manet, that is, with the beginnings of pictorial modernism, and ending with Lacan, that is, with the advent of post-structuralism, suggests that a major philosophical break with Kant has occurred sometimes during modernity, or perhaps all along. This break is not that universality should be abandoned or criticized as metaphysical. That was Kant's achievement already, in a way. The advent of critical philosophy meant that transcendentalism, the a priori, the necessary and the universal, can no longer be accepted as a basic belief. They ought to be postulated. Our break with Kant is elsewhere. It lies in the fact that we can no longer think of the universal as being necessary. Rather, it has become impossible. By which I don't mean, of course, that it has ceased to exist, for it has never existed, never having been more than a claim, a need, or a desire. What I mean is that impossibility, not necessity, has become the logical modality under which the claim to universality maintains itself. The impossibility of universality, of consensus, for example, in matters of taste, as in political matters, is our universality, the one that has been bequeathed to us, postmoderns, by modernism, and the one we have the duty to guard. Also, it seems, at least to men, whose authority in everyday sexual politics has always rested upon the prerogative of universality. It is not for a man to say what this duty could mean to a woman. So, I'll hand it over to Barbara Johnson, who speaks for herself, certainly, for women in general, probably, although I doubt she speaks for women at large. And I quote again, "The process of de-universalization can never be universally completed."